If a company tapped your phone line, listened to your conversations, and then tried to sell you products based on what you said, you'd be pretty upset, I'd guess. What if they opened your mail, copied down what you wrote and any pictures you enclosed for future reference? Or they looked over your shoulder when you looked up something in an encyclopedia or a health reference book? Well, when you go online, my guest says similar things happen to you all the time. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. It's Thursday, January 10th, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we'll look at online privacy, or the lack thereof. My guest is Lori Andrews. She's a law professor and director of the Institute for Science, Law, and Technology at the Illinois Institute of Technology. She's the author of I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did, Social Networks and the Death of Privacy. Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us today. Well, I mentioned things like tapping our phone lines, opening the mail, and so forth. We have some legal protections there.
But we have protections where police need a warrant before they go in your house. Your boss can't drop in on a party unless he's invited. Otherwise, it would be trespass. But our online self isn't as protected. And increasingly, information is being used against us. I mean, one in four college admissions officers looks at online profiles, and 75% of employers say they require their human resources department to look at your online self. So you may be denied a job without even knowing, you know, what the cause was. In fact, about a third of employers have turned people down because they've had a wine glass in their hand, even in the sort of seemingly innocent wedding photo on their Facebook page.
Let's dig into social networks a little deeper. I think it was in your book you told a story of a teacher, speaking of holding a glass of alcohol, her trip to Ireland ended up costing her job.
Yes, Ashley Payne. So she was a 24-year-old high school teacher, and she had not friended any students or any parents of students. And like many people in that age group, when she went on a summer vacation to Ireland, she posted 700 photos. She only posted a few in which she had a glass of beer in her hand. She went on the Guinness tour of a factory in Ireland. So it was, you know, perfectly reasonable. She was of age. She was, you know, the pictures were quite innocent. She's on a tour drinking a little Guinness. She was forced out of her job as a result of it. We're seeing all sorts of things like that. Straight-A students have been expelled from school for criticizing their classes, their teachers on MySpace. Teenagers in Los Angeles have been arrested as being gang members because they've worn gang colors in photos on their MySpace or Facebook page. Well, I looked at what's a gang color, according to the LAPD, and it's plaid. Think any hipster, or all black. Think New York art opening. But if you're poor and you don't have, you know, a lawyer handy to challenge it, you may have a charge against you for being a gangbanger.
And if you criticize your workplace on Facebook, say, you might be at risk.
Yeah. In fact, when a 22-year-old woman was offered a job at Cisco, she tweeted about how she now had to weigh the utility of, quote, a fatty paycheck against hating the work. Well, immediately, you know, someone at the company read the tweet and the woman's job offer was withdrawn. I mean, similarly, a 16-year-old who said, oh my God, my job is boring on her Facebook page, didn't even tell the company that she worked at, but I guess a fellow employee must have ratted her out and she lost her job. So the law is trying to figure out what to do about this. And it turns out, in the employment setting, there are some protections for people. So, you know, the Pittsburgh Pirates mascot, a guy who posed as a pierogi for the pierogi races, lost his job when he criticized a management decision. But he got it back because he looked at the employee handbook and they hadn't followed the rules for how, you know, the circumstances under which they could fire him. So, you know, if you have a problem on a social network, first look at the employee handbook. Then look at your state laws. About 8 states have laws that say you can't be fired for legal off-duty conduct. So you couldn't be fired in those states for a picture with alcohol in your hand on your social network page. And then there's some federal laws that say if you're organizing other workers, if you're actually engaged in a concerted activity to change the nature of the workplace, you know, criticizing, you know, poor hours or unsafe conditions, that might protect you. But for the most part, employment law says you're an employee at will. You can be fired for whatever reason, including your posts.
Now, isn't this just a matter of I, the user, need to be more careful what I put on Facebook, on Twitter, even if I think it's just going to my friends? It's out there in the public. So I should just be more careful what I put out there.
Well, all of us know that we shouldn't post incriminating things, naked hot tub photos.
You'd think.
Yeah, you know, although people do it all the time, which is crazy. But we might not realize how seemingly innocent things can get us into trouble. So women have lost custody of their kids to the ex-husbands because they posted a sexy photo on Facebook. They don't know, you know, they may not realize, and it's completely wrong. The judges shouldn't be using that as evidence without looking at the actual state of health and well-being of the child. But courts increasingly take your online self to be more important than your offline self. Another example is you might not think it's problematic to post a picture of yourself smiling on your Facebook page. But in New York, a woman was badly injured in a workplace accident. She brought a liability suit, and she'd undergone four spinal surgeries, had pins in her neck, and the judge actually said if she was smiling in her Facebook photos, she couldn't really be that badly hurt. Not even asking, are those photos from before the accident? You know, shouldn't we allow people to have a stiff upper lip on the web, you know, and you know, show themselves in a positive light? So even seemingly unproblematic things could be used against you.
Rob Ferret, talking to Lori Andrews about her book, I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did, Social Networks and the Death of Privacy, talking about online privacy and whether we really have any when we post things on Facebook, when we tweet. It's out there for a world, for the world to see, and not a ton of legal protections for how that gets used by an employer, by a court. What do you think? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Do you think we need more legal protections for our communications online? You can also email talk at WPR.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Be careful with your photos there, though. Lori Andrews, it's more than just social media, isn't it? You write about our searches. When we're searching for someone online, That doesn't just go away when we click away from what we searched for.
That was the most shocking thing about writing this book, to learn about data aggregators. So it turns out that there are big companies like Axiom, which calls itself the biggest company you never heard of, and they say they have 1,500 pieces of information on 96% of Americans. So what does that mean? If I do a Google search for old guitars, maybe I'm not even interested in buying one. Maybe I'm writing about it for a novel. And then I go to a credit card site, I'll actually get a less good credit card, not because my credit's bad, but because the assumption is if I'm looking for an old guitar, I'm in a garage rock band, and those people tend not to pay off their credit cards. So searches that you do get analyzed, and you know, some of it can be positive. I might get money off at a store I like, or I may find out where my favorite band's playing. But in other instances, it can be used against me. I was shocked that all the Google products, Gmail, Google Plus, Google Searches, YouTube, collect data, share data across formats, and Google makes 96% of its income, over $36 billion a year, marketing that information about me. So if I say to my sister in a private email over Gmail, I'm thinking of getting a divorce, again, I will get a lower credit card limit. I'll get a less good credit card on a credit card website. It turns out now consultants are saying to life insurance companies that you should forget about doing the blood and urine test to figure out who should get life insurance because that costs the company money. Instead, they say, look at a person's social network page. And it turns out that these are the factors they think should be used against you in terms of denying you life insurance, that you're an avid reader, that you commute to work, or that you eat junk food. You know, so if I've done a Google search for the nearest McDonald's, or I've got a lot of books on Goodreads, that could, you know, lead to my being thought of as not meriting life insurance, which is crazy because I could be reading those books on the treadmill. I could be, you know, I could be more worthy of life insurance than someone just playing video games. And yet every little bit of activity I do on the web can come back to haunt me. The other thing that the consultants are telling life insurance companies to take into consideration is whether you have friends on your Facebook page who do risky things like skydiving. And they actually say that with no basis, in fact, that behavior is contagious. So if I have a hang gliding friend, the assumption is that I must, too. I mean, I have a friend who loves Harley-Davidson shirts, so I'm always buying in different parts of the country Harley-Davidson shirts as presents. But, you know, this makes it seem like I'm, having risky behavior and maybe shouldn't be given a credit card or life insurance.
You're doing shots while riding your Harley through
absolutely.
A crowded
riding it backwards,
street.
No helmet.
So
that's me to a T, right?
Let me paint the big picture. They take our social media lives, our online searches and all that, aggregate it in all these ways, and then they have all these, they correlate it. They say people who have that Harley-Davidson shirt are 70% likely to ride a motorcycle without a helmet, and maybe something not even related, more likely to drink or whatever. They paint this picture, they flesh it out with what they think based on percentages, and then that ends up affecting what you might pay for life insurance, health insurance. Can employers get access to this kind of data too?
Yes, and it's so some companies specifically market to employers, and there's a company whose entire business model is to keep the last 7 years worth of everybody's Facebook pages, the public end of them. So, you know, we've heard the expression life begins at 40. Well, it might end at 14 for the next generation in the sense that if they've liked a violent video game when they're 14 or if when they're 17 they've posted underage drinking photos and then they clean up their Facebook page when they're 18, you know, take down those photos and so forth, this company, Social Intelligence Inc., you know, sells to employers the last 7 years worth of public information about people from their Facebook pages. So it doesn't go away. It's there. And some of the business model of companies is to make this available to employers. I was shocked when a talent agency in Los Angeles, one that represents a lot of hard drinking stars and so forth, actually turned down for employment, a kid who had a college drinking photo up on his Facebook page. And they actually said, you won't get a job at any talent agency in Los Angeles because of that. Well, think about it. These are the guys that, you know, represent Charlie Sheen.
I was
going
to say, we don't
want to
tarnish Charlie Sheen's good name by having somebody who took a drink in high school.
Yeah. And so, it does linger, and you're completely right that we're now not treated as individuals but as algorithms, and some of it is just wrong. I mean, I may subscribe to Hang Glider Weekly because I like the pictures and not because I'm going to go jump off a mountain someplace. It's particularly bad with respect to searches about medical conditions. Mm-hmm. So I might have a grandmother or a friend, or I might be doing a research project where I search for dementia or the side effects of a sleeping pill, or I actually do pro bono cases for school kids with diabetes, and so I'll search for diabetes. I don't have diabetes, but that's put in the algorithm in terms of what is then offered to me or not offered to me, what jobs. So here's a crazy thing. Federal laws say my potential employer can't ask me as a job applicant, oh, are you planning to get pregnant? Do you have cancer? You know, that's against federal laws. But what if on my Facebook page I say, oh, recently married, love to have a baby in the next few years? Or what if I like the American Cancer Society? I might like a walk they do, or I might like the work they do and not have any glimmer of cancer in my family. An employer can look at that off my Facebook page, get access to information it shouldn't have, turn me down for a job, and I never know it. Never know it. So most states, it's perfectly legal for employers to ask you for the password to your private side of your social network page, where you might have those, you know, photos of a, you know, girls' night out where you have, you know, a ginger martini in your hand or things like that, or might have information about, you know, you're trying to get pregnant and so forth. So think how different that is from credit bureaus. If I'm turned down for a credit card because of information from a credit rating agency, I am told that. I have a chance to correct that information. But if I lose a job because, you know, some mistaken idea that an employer has based on my liking the American Cancer Society or liking a Facebook page that has to do with health, and 5 million Americans like Facebook pages that have to do with health, 80% of people search for medical information online. You know, all these wrong decisions are being made, or decisions where even if they're right, they're against federal laws that want to protect, you know, pregnant women in the workforce.
And when we search online, whether it's for that, you know, how to subscribe to Hang Gliders Anonymous or about cancer or anything like that, should we assume that our data is being collected every time we enter that search phrase?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's obviously being collected by the search engines themselves, such as Google. But you may not know that when you go to websites, they put tracking mechanisms on your computer. I've written 14 books. I've written this internet privacy book. I've written mystery books, all these things. I love dictionary.com. I had no idea until it was revealed in a study in the Wall Street Journal that dictionary.com puts 233 tracking mechanisms on my computer to see where I go. In the most recent presidential campaign, both the Romney camp and the Obama camp put cookies on your computer and, you know, looked at whether you went to Bible sites, whether you went to porno sites or both. And then if you went to campaign sites, they would target their message to you. So we have two things going on. We have search engines collecting information, and then we have tracking mechanisms collecting information as well.
Well, now, as a mystery author,
oh my goodness,
big data must have some really weird impressions of you, because you might look for, you know, effective stab wound or something like that.
You are so right. I blew up the White House in one of my mystery books. I invented a date rape drug in another. So I was searching all these chemical compounds that could, you know, make you forget about what happened to you and so forth. And it's heaven forbid my dear sister should disappear because, you know, cops could use those searches against me. It turns out that whole criminal cases have been based on Google searches for weapons, for the length of a lake nearby, the depth of a lake nearby. And so it is scary for those of us who, you know, write fiction where bad things happen to good people. You know, but even what you like. So one spouse in a divorce case on his Facebook page had liked a story in which harm came to a judge. Well, the judge used that against him. And in another case, someone working for a political nominee liked on his Facebook page the person's rival and got fired. And a court actually said, your likes are not protected. This is in Virginia. Your likes are not protected by the First Amendment.
Maybe you just want to keep tabs on the other campaign, though, in that instance.
Yeah, absolutely. You could be actually doing a better job. And so, you know, it's the 225th anniversary of the U.S. Constitution. We have all these protections, free speech, privacy, offline, and I think we need to get those same sort of protections for people online as well.
That's Lori Andrews, she's professor and director of the Institute for Science, Law, and Technology at the Illinois Institute of Technology. She's the author of I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did, Social Networks and the Death of Privacy. We're talking about the lack of privacy, the surveillance that goes on by companies and others for when we go online. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow at this time, it's the Week in Review. I'll get two perspectives on all the top stories of the week, including calls for gun control, shakeups in the federal cabinet, a whole lot more here in the state, too. This hour, talking to Lori Andrews about internet privacy and how little of it we have, talking about her book, I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did, Social Networks and the Death of Privacy. We'll get to your calls now with Tim in Ladysmith. Hi there, Tim.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Very interesting program. This kind of reminds me of, I think it's Huxley wrote the book Brave New World, if I'm not mistaken, that said It's not the things that we fear that may be our undoing, but the things we love. And I guess this is it's a very eye-opening. I knew some of this was going on, but not to the extent your guest is talking about. I guess one of the things that really concerns me about this is, number one, it seems like a total violation of the First Amendment. But secondly, in this world of so much political correctness, I'm extremely concerned about this, that, you know, the things that today people can't express themselves without be calling racist or particular genres, and to what degree I'm concerned that in the hands of the wrong people, this can, it's already in the hands of the wrong people, it seems, but it just seems like such a destructive thing. And I don't know, it seems like the tip of the iceberg, that as people become more and more addicted to cell phones and their private life becomes accessible, and as I was seeing the other day, that cell phones are now, they have no protection at all, hardly, against your privacy. This seems to be just such a Pandora's box that we've opened, and I don't know how it's going to get shut. So,
thanks, Tim.
Tim, that's very, you know, very true what you've said. It is the things we love, and we're in an interesting situation because these are private companies, you know, Facebook, and that they're not the government, and so all those protections in the Constitution, the First Amendment, and so forth, are protections against the government, you know, stepping on your rights. So we don't have a really good model for what to do when it's, you know, companies that we otherwise love, and so security analyst Richard Powers said something I find very provocative. He said, think of all that, you know, like the billion people on Facebook and what they post. And so when I think about it, you know, you might post your whether you like your boss or not, your sexual preference, your political beliefs, and so forth. And Richard Powers said, if the government tried to get that information, it would take money, it would take lawyers, it might even take guns. But we give it up because we love these technologies. And it turns out that 93% of the time, when the government asks Google for the information we posted, Google turns it over. So we actually are, you know, giving it up to the government. And you pointed out that, you know, there's not really room there for, you know, joking or exploring, you know.
Venting.
Yeah, venting, you know. I mean, so employees used to go down to the neighborhood bar and, you know, have a drink and talk about their boss, and we didn't expect the boss to follow. And union officials say that venting on Facebook should be the same, should be viewed the same way.
You know, if this is something we love, we get it for free. We don't have to pay for Facebook or our search engine or any of that. Is this just the price of admission? They got to make money somehow?
So you could say that, you know, but you don't really get it for free if what's happening is that they're marketing that data in a way that you're going to lose jobs, lose money elsewhere. And so shouldn't they be more honest? I mean, Facebook really only makes $4 per person per year on all these services. I'd gladly pay $5 or $10 to a competitor to get the same thing through, you know, but with privacy protections. But we're not given that choice. We're not even told. And I think that one thing that's happening is that even the technologies we pay for, we sometimes aren't as wary as we should be or inquisitive about what they actually can do. It turns out some of the apps can remotely then turn on your microphone to collect data about you from your phone, like whether you eat in restaurants or at home or have sex with someone of the same sex or the opposite sex. And I think about that incredible Pennsylvania case where a high school gave free laptops to all the students and didn't tell the students or their parents that the cameras could be remotely accessed from the school by the IT department. And it turns out that those working in the computer department at the school were only supposed to turn them on if a laptop got stolen so they could take a picture of the thief. Instead, they took tens of thousands of photos of these high school students in their homes. And where do high school students have their laptop open? In their bedroom. They're coming out of the shower. They're in bed and so forth. And it only came to light when one of the students was called into the assistant principal's office and said, hey, here's a picture of you. You have illegal drugs in your hand. And he was shocked to see it's a picture of him in his bedroom. And he looked at his hand, and what he had was Mike and Ike's candies. So we don't even know the capabilities of our technologies in terms of invading privacy. I mean, since then, I've like got this posted over my laptop camera, and you know, and when I checked into a hotel where the you could only order room service by going on a little iPad they had and agreeing to the pages and pages of terms of service, I ended up eating Raisinets from the bottom of my purse instead of like, you know, turning on the camera in my hotel room.
We'll go now to Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Yeah, it does create a lot of paranoia. I had a friend. I've been telling my kids for years to watch what they're doing, that eventually an employer is going to look at their pages, and I hope that they listen to me. I think they do. What happened to a friend of mine years ago, he was accused of a crime, simply accused. He was found innocent after all the hubbub, but what they did is the police had come, hooked up a device to his phone, withdrew all the information out of his phone, withdrew all the information from his iPad, which has a GPS system that, you know, Apple has put in there that traces everywhere you go. If you got the iPad with you, you are being traced everywhere you go. I had gotten rid of even the little cards. They scoured the city for my friend to see what stores he went to, even if he paid in cash, if he used the little card. Do you have your little discount card? We'll use that. They're keeping track of everything that you're doing. So I don't use any of those. It's not worth it to me. I think the solution is taxes. I believe this is not a First Amendment. It could be a Fourth Amendment, illegal search, if the government eventually is getting your information. But, you know, if they're paying $4 for the information, well, fine. We'll put a $100 tax on every $4 purchase. We need to do something. We need to find out who the politicians are that are allowing employers to get passwords for your private site.
Gotcha, Dave. I'm going to cut in there because you gave us a lot to think about. Let's talk a little bit about some of the political or legal solutions that Dave was starting to touch on there, Lori Andrews.
Yeah, it turns out there are some politicians, Congressman Ed Markey from Massachusetts, who's a Democrat, and Republican Joe Barton from Texas, who want to do something about this. And, you know, Senator Al Franken, you know, but they feel like they're not hearing enough from the public that they, you know, and it's because most people don't realize this is going on until they're, you know, in the thick of it, like your friend. and so, you know, they're receptive. And in Illinois, where I'm from, we did pass a law last summer that went into effect January 1st to prevent employers from getting access to your social network password. I think what happened is judges made a wrong turn at the start of the Internet, and they said that your right to privacy is lost on your affirmative keystroke. Anything you put on the web is not private. I mean, that's silly now that you have to make doctor's appointments online, now that, you know, I mean, as a lawyer, I'm sending briefs online, you know, over confidential briefs over to be, you know, looked at by my pro bono clients and so forth. So I think we need to rethink that. We've got to get judges protecting privacy. We've got to do more in the political sphere to say that, you know, our online selves should be as protected as our offline selves. Dave brought up the issue of location information. That's huge. And I found out recently that before, if the cops wanted to find out from my wireless carrier where I was, they'd have to make a request and go through a lot of hubbub. Now the wireless carriers actually have started businesses where cops just subscribe and get as many searches as they want and can pull all the location information. That's extremely problematic because, as Justice Sotomayor said in a Supreme Court case last year, location information can tell so much about you personally, politically, and so forth. It can tell whether a person's gone to an HIV clinic, to an abortion clinic, whether the person goes to a mosque or a church or a synagogue, whether the person is meeting with the competitor of their current employer. And in that case, the Supreme Court decided 9-0 that this was a violation of the right to privacy, of the unfair search and seizure on the Fourth Amendment for cops to put a GPS device and follow someone around without a warrant, you know, not follow them around, but get the data from everywhere they were. Police are routinely getting that information from, the wireless service providers. So we really do need to do something. I'm finding there are receptive lawmakers, but not enough people are speaking up, in part because they don't even know this is happening.
Know it's there. Thanks for the call, Dave. We'll go now to Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there. Thanks a lot. I have so many questions, but my question is, I don't have a computer. I really have two questions. Okay, one, don't have a computer, so I do everything in the library. I log into the library system to get online, and then I don't really log in anywhere else. I mean, I'll log into Yahoo to get my mail, but like, so for Google searches or purchases, then can they track me because I've logged into the library to give them my name? I mean, so that the
So you don't buy books on Amazon, you don't make airplane reservations on Southwest, or you do that through the library?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so, I mean, if you do that through the library and you go on Southwest, you got to put your name and credit card in. So they've got that, and then they could say, oh, this person whose name we know because they've entered it into a particular website, at the same time, at that same computer, looked at XYZ. So part of what's happening is that the search engines and so forth are saying, oh, we're only selling non-identifiable information. We're not selling Sarah's name. But it turns out you don't need that much, that many data points to tell who it is. So if I do Google Maps that start from the same address in Chicago, and then I look at how my book's doing on Amazon.com, and then I look up a health condition, you know, they can relate that health condition back to me, even though they don't have my name. So in part, it's about, who's doing what on the computer at the same time and so forth.
Here's a post on Facebook from Samantha. She writes, Facebook privacy settings change automatically. If I post something on Facebook that is only to friends, seems these posts can go to friends of friends. And then the process to change this privacy setting seems to be quite cumbersome. And I remember not long ago, there was a wave of emails telling us, if we type this thing on Facebook, then they can't use our data or something like that, which was complete bunk. Is there anything we could do to use Facebook and change a setting to protect ourselves a little bit?
Well, they do at least have more options in terms of sharing. But the problem with Facebook is you have to almost continuously monitor it because they, you know, here's another way that Facebook is different than the government. The government has under the Constitution, has to comply with due process. Before they change something major, they have to give you notice and, get input from you. You know, I think back to 2009, Facebook originally said, we are not going to share your information with anyone except those people you specifically say. And then in 2009, they made people's friends' photos and names public, and you couldn't do anything about that. So they changed their privacy settings radically. And what happened was horrible because in the U.S., there were critics of the Iranian government, but some of them had friends or relatives in Tehran, and all of a sudden those pictures of their friends and relatives with their names became public, and back in Iran, those people got beat up, got arrested. So a simple thing even of who your friends are could have huge risk. And all I can say is Facebook keeps changing their privacy policy to make it less about privacy and more about what they can do with your data. I mean, think about the fact that you agree when you go on Facebook to, if you like something, to have your name and image used in ads for that thing, you know, a violent video game, a particular drugstore, those sorts of things.
Samantha also writes, if you use ad block while you're searching online, does that change what is collected about you?
I think that there are a couple things you can do. You can search in incognito mode. You can use various, various things. Mainly what they do is, in some senses, protect you from very targeted ads so that I don't consistently get ads that are about a medical condition if I've searched for something related to it. So what they do is limit how scared you get, how individualized the ads get. But they're still collecting that information. They're just not targeting you with it. They're still, you know. So, I mean, people have done things like, the Electronic Frontier Foundation is a great organization. They have some information on their website about how to use an anonymizer with your searches and so forth. But if you've already been on a website that's put tracking mechanisms on your computer, then that doesn't do that much good. So you can be savvy. There are things you can do. I'd love to see more entrepreneurs developing privacy-enhancing technologies as opposed to privacy-invading ones, because I think there's a real market for it.
Rob Ferret talking to Lori Andrews about her book, I Know Who You Are and Saw What You Did, Social Networks and the Death of Privacy, talking about all the ways we probably don't even know about that our data is collected and shared and used by employers, other companies, advertisers, sometimes even the government. 800-642-1234 if you want to join the conversation. Rob Ferret filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After 10 with Kathleen Dunn, in 1961, a dictionary published a word that shocked the nation. The word ain't. Kathleen's guest tells us the story of ain't, America, its language, and the most controversial dictionary ever published. This hour, we are talking about privacy when we go online, whether we're searching for information about a medical condition, shopping, posting on Facebook, all that data can come back to haunt us later. My guest is Lori Andrews. She's the author of I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did, Social Networking and the Death of Privacy. Lori, before we take another call, I have this picture in my head of Gene Hackman in the movie, the Will Smith movie, Enemy of the State. He has cut himself off from the grid. He has this private compound. He has computers that aren't connected to any other network in the world. And I'm wondering, is that what it's going to take to protect ourselves from our data being collected? Do we have to completely unplug, or is there something else we can do?
Unplugging is about where we're at until, you know, we can get some protections in place. And now something that was thought of shut down by the federal government as totally inappropriate 10 years ago is routinely being done, which is to link your offline purchases with your online purchases to get an even better picture of you. You know, as your one caller pointed out, you know, even if you pay in cash, but use your CVS card or your Jewel shopping card or whatever the local equivalents are, you know, there are records about what you do. I mean, and then, you know, you have all the cameras that are everywhere. You know, in Chicago, elsewhere, you know, seeing where you go in that way.
And you wrote in your book that they're actually developing, some companies, entrepreneurs are developing things that, say, at a restaurant, match up the image of your face, find you online, and then just by seeing you in a place, they can link you up with your online data?
Yes, and so think about it. You're walking down the street, you know, someone thinks you're cute, or someone, you know, thinks you're someone they hated in junior high. They take a little picture, this technology called PeakU, would use facial recognition to look and see what your blogs are, what your home address is, do you have a profile on a dating site, you know, what political contributions you've made, and so forth. And we've talked about, you know, freedom of expression being dampened by this and privacy being invaded. But there's another whole aspect to this, which is that people's right to fair trial, there are even problems there. It turns out that one woman who couldn't make up her mind about whether a person should be found guilty of a crime or not actually posted the facts of the case on her Facebook page and asked people to vote up or down.
This is a juror we're talking about.
Yeah, a juror. So even though jurors are only supposed to be influenced by what's going on in the courtroom, the facts of the case, now they're going online and looking at the MySpace page of a witness and thinking, oh, that person's not credible, or doing a Google map to the place where the crime occurred and saying, oh, well, there's a street light there. The witness must have been able to see it. And what happens is the attorneys in the case don't even know what's going on and don't have a chance to rebut it and say, oh, that street light wasn't effective that night. It was burned out. It was rainy. And so kind of every aspect of our society, from presidential elections to trials to marketing to jobs, has been profoundly changed by social networks and the new internet technologies.
Back to the phones now with Matt in Middleton. Hi, Matt.
Yeah, good morning. I think there's a couple of aspects here that you've touched on that I like the movie aspect that you talked about, but I think we're more in the Minority Report type situation than we are in the other one. The part that bothers me is less the corporate espionage, which is typically what I call the information gathering. It's that a lot of this information, the government has an interest in not having laws preventing this type of information because it's the perfect type of surveillance society. What we have in modern society today is what the Soviets in the 50s and the 60s were salivating at, being able to collect all of this information. And the idea that by installing an ad blocker or something else we can prevent tracking, it is really naive. I mean, we have to connect to an ISP, and the ISP can watch every single place that we go to. So it's very easy for a profile to be built around you. You know, without, you can install an ad blocker, but if you're sending or receiving anything, that information is tracked. And if the government has a case against you or think they might have a pre-crime case, hey, he's visiting a lot of Iranian websites when you might be, you know, developing a dissertation paper for college, they might say, well, look, he's researched bombs, he's researched the Middle East, he's researched Iran, so he's now part of the, preventing terrorism clause.
Gotcha. Thanks for the call, Matt. Is that a valid concern, Lori?
It is, actually. It turns out that a lot of this information is turned over to the government. And I think about now Google, Facebook have such strong lobbying arms. When California, the state legislature, tried to do something about it, you know, they got trampled when they tried to protect internet privacy. And it's funny because Google and Facebook always say, oh, we're doing this to improve the experience of the user. You know, and in some ways it might, you know, to know I like to read certain types of mystery books and, you know, getting ads from Amazon, well, you might like this. But in other ways, it's really potentially harming my life. And just recently, there was an 18-month investigation by the Federal Trade Commission of Google to see if they were violating antitrust laws. And there was some speculation when, at the end of it, the case, you know, the investigation was dismissed with just a 4-page letter, oh, Google's doing fine, whether, you know, in fact, you know, the government did have a real interest in not being able, in a situation where they're not able to collect a lot of this information directly, to relying on companies to do it. I mean, lots of the government agencies, the CIA and so forth, are just love social networks. I mean, the IRS, the immigration services, they all have manuals for their employees that say, you know, look at people's social network profiles. So if they're trying to see whether my marriage to a foreign national is a sham for him to get a green card, they'll look at my social network page and they'll see how many pictures we're in together versus alone. Now think about whether that is a good fact or not. I have a son. There are virtually no pictures of his dad and me and him, you know, together, because one or the other of the parents is always taking the photo. So you could have the assumption that, you know, if my husband had been a foreign national, that it was a sham marriage, just because, you know, with two people, it's usually one taking a picture of the other person. So every law enforcement agency loves social networks and Google searches.
Now, one of the things you've written is a social network constitution, I think you called it. You've got a lot of suggestions in terms of changing the law and changing attitudes, and that's the part I want to get into. Do we need a different mindset about how we think about privacy and our rights when we go online?
We do, and I'd love to have people. I've got a socialnetworkconstitution.com website, socialnetworkconstitution.com, where, you know, people can help me figure out what the provision should be. But it is a different mindset. So here's what I see. People are saying, you know, privacy's dead, get over it, you know, we can't turn back the clock. But it turns out that people have said that about every technology for the last 125 years. So in 1888, Kodak came out with a portable camera. Before, you could control your image because you would go into a studio, you'd get dressed up, you'd portray yourself the way you wanted. And newspaper articles in the late 1800s actually called the portable camera the Kodak fiend. And they said it could, you know, catch you in these are the words, an uncouth position in a line at the post office. So it's just like tagging on Facebook. There could be, you know, ugly photos of you or photos of you in places you shouldn't be. And so initially, you know, people thought in the late 1800s, privacy is dead. But what happened was laws were adopted to protect and even expand privacy. Or take genetics, which is another area I write in. When it turned out that someone could take your water bottle that you discarded and do a DNA profile from the saliva on it, initially people said, you know, privacy is dead, and health insurers and employers were using your genetic code. But ultimately, federal law was passed saying that you do have genetic privacy, and employers can't test your genes or require that you give up a tissue sample for testing. So every other area, medical, forensics, other computer areas, we've actually ultimately expanded privacy. So we just all need to get on this social network constitution or other set of laws, because otherwise, particularly the next generation, you know, their lives will be ruined by video games they played and things they liked on their Facebook page when they were in middle school.
Just a few seconds to answer. Are you optimistic that we'll get better protections for online privacy?
Yes, I am. I am optimistic, because more and more people are being burned and are looking for a way to protect themselves.
Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Rob.
That's Lori Andrews, law professor, director of the Institute for Science, Law, and Technology at the Illinois Institute of Technology. We've been talking mainly about her book, I Know Who You Are, and I Saw What You Did, Social Networks and the Death of Privacy. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for producing today's program. Thanks to Bill Martins for on-air direction. Cynthia Schuster looks like, yep, she's been answering your calls as well. Thank you for listening and for calling into the show. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.